Well, so it's a real pleasure to be here. I must admit that you create what I dream of for science, like having conferences where you dance with people before talking to them and waking up in the morning feeling your body. And so I'm going to speak about social interaction, which has been like a core topic in my research. And initially, I had this very complex title, but to make it more phenomenological, what I want to speak about today is how there is something more when we are interacting that you cannot have at the individual level. And so this is very embedded in this poetry sentence by Francis Huxley, that the bee dream of the flower and the flower dream of the bee. Bee and flower are together in a way that if you take one out, both of them disappear. And now I'm doing genetics and evolution, and it's also making sense in that way, that there is something that connects things that we see separate in a meaningful manner. And so basically, my talk is about how a scientist tried to make sense of that, while it's not very easy at first, and through connecting facts, experiments, and theory and models. And for that, I will present first a technique that I developed in EEG for recording brain activity of two people simultaneously while they are interacting in spontaneous interaction. Then how you can simulate with virtual brains what you observed in the facts and make sense of what you observed there. And then briefly mention the combination of the two with a human interacting with the model and to what extent the model can be taken as a human, so like a nonverbal Turing test. But as an introduction, I want to say that indeed some people talk about social interaction and joint improvisation being like the real extreme of this social interactive case as a dark matter part of social neuroscience and cognitive neuroscience, because like paradoxically, most of the study of the social processes taking place in one brain have been studied in one brain, like in isolated people. And so the big challenge is to have like protocols, experiments with two individuals and even more engage emotionally and in the task in an ecological manner and with the dynamic interaction. So with like really not something that is sequential, but where like as we experience with contact dance, something that is bidirectional and coupling in real time. So the big deal is how we go there and how we operationalize that in a scientific manner. So another disclaimer is about, so we have different fields, different perspective, and cognitive science is not an exception on that. And there's a lot of theories, and there's a lot of plurality, and it's good. And I don't know if you're familiar with this myth of the blind man and the elephant, but I think cognition is a little bit like that. Like in you have this huge topic, and the physicist would see the brain and cognition in a way, the artist and the dancer or choreographer would see another way, and this is the best way to exchange and try to make a global picture. So for instance, in cognitive neuroscience, there are like different theories. And so for instance, I'm more like a crazy dynamicist trying to take the problem by the tail. So the Bayesian guys are on top at the right moment. Cognitivists taking the brain as a computer is kind of falling apart those days. But so like we are trying to make sense of that complex topic. And in my case, I came up I'm from physics by training, but I encountered cognitive science for the first time by reading a book called The Tree of Knowledge by Umberto Maturana and Francisco Varela, who are two Chilean guys who were crazy enough to, while they were developing the molecular biology, not taking this mainstream approach, but trying to conceptualize life in a different perspective. And what's funny is that how with chalk and boards without computers and so on, they just create a conceptual framework that helped afterwards to conceptualize also cognition and our way to be in the world in a different perspective as a computer manipulating symbols. And so what's interesting in there is that they present also like the way you observe science being made in a very dimensional way. So like Uri yesterday talked about the A straight to B, but in science also it's like very a swarm exploring a space of understanding. And so like depending on the field, but depending on the your sensibility, it shifts the way you are speaking and the way you formulate the thing. So I'm part of this bias, so it's another disclaimer. And so to before talking about social interaction, I want to go at the straight beginning, like the cell. So in the beginning with the Maturana and Varela's work, they were studying the life and cells toward two concepts, like autonomy and coupling. And it's very funny how just simplifying a complex problem like life with just two concepts like that complementary can be scaled up to other problems. So for instance, in the case of the cell, so they say, well, we have this entity that maintains a kind of autonomy, an individuality, in an environment that's fluctuating. And so you have a coupling of matter and energy and so on with the cell. And meanwhile, the cell has a loop of causality that creates a boundary, creates this individuality. And meanwhile, the boundary allows the process to take place. So why I'm talking about that? Maybe you think I'm crazy. So the thing is that once you have this kind of coupling with an environment, you can have other cells that share the same mode of coupling with the environment. And by having the same kind of coupling, they can actually couple between each other. So the coupling between cells can be completely epiphenomenally caused by the fact that they have to couple with the same environment. And to make the jump from cells to organism, the thing is that once you have many cells coupling with between each other, then you can have like more complex systems such as the nervous system. So neurons and how actually it's more a network of cells than blobs or individual brain area, but more like a mesh, a rhizome of cells. And so I told you that the interesting part was to scale up the metaphor. And in the same way as the cell was an individual, an entity at the physical level, you can conceptualize a cognitive agent as also an individual that has an informational individuality. So it creates a meaning towards the world, and while being in an environment informationally fluctuating, it maintains a kind of stability of the meaning towards the environment. In the same way as there were like a metabolic network creating a boundary that created the individuality, here you have like sensory motor coupling with the environment that modulate the dynamics of this mesh of neurons, the nervous system, and the nervous system is modulating the way you are coupled to perception and action with the environment. And so to finish, to scale up the metaphor, in the same way as the cell coupled with the environment have the ability to couple between each other, in the same way, once you achieve autonomy at the physical and informational level and maintain a stable coupling with the environment, then you can have the same coupling with others. And that's third order structural coupling, as they call it, is basically social interaction. So you are exchanging true perception and action with other organisms. And so that was the grand start of my PhD. And the idea was two brains and two bodies in social interaction coupled with true perception and action. In the same way as we observe synchronization between cells in the brain, we can observe synchronization of the two brains, the two nervous system of the two individuals, while they are interacting without an external signal, without a metronome, like a pure endogenous coupling between the two. And so that can be observed in children, for instance, this kind of copying. So for instance, this is work from my co-supervisor, and she was filming children without adults. So one guy has the idea of putting a chair on his head, and suddenly it becomes like so attractive. The other are following. And so this kind of mode of interacting through imitation and synchronization is quite natural. And we can observe that as well in animals. So for instance, like in monkeys, the propensity to get synchronized, it's like a little bit more like military, but but so we have this tendency of coupling. And fortunately, there is like a tool that have been developed by initially Reed Montagu teams called hyperscanning. So it's called hyperscanning, we asked yesterday, because it was in fMRI initially, so it's the scanning come from there. And hyper, I don't know, that after that there were like hyper methods, hyper something. There's like the paper by Babiloni called Hyper Methods for Hyperscanning, so like the hyper title. But so the idea of hyperscanning is just to couple two neuroimaging devices simultaneously to have a real social interaction and study it in an objective manner in, simultaneously. And initially it was used a lot in neuroeconomic settings, so more like sequential type of interaction. And also like kind of fake hyperscanning. So for instance, Uri Hassan in Princeton used also a similar approach to probe natural setting and natural perception. So for instance, in this case, he recorded many people while watching The Good, the Bad, and the Ugly. I don't know if you're familiar with this wonderful movie, Western movie. And so like the idea was to look at to what extent their brain activity was synchronized. While they were watching this movie. And interestingly, they found that indeed there were like peaks of synchronization that were corresponding to social moments in the movie. So that they tend to be more similar when the movie was about social. So that's a first good message. And the other is like, makes sense, is that the more you are near the coupling with the environment, the more you are similar. Because of course you are sharing the environment. So the visual system was very synchronized because they were watching the same stimuli, but then you have a gradient of similarity between people up to very more higher order structure. So Babiloni and the hyper methods for EEG hyperscanning. So meanwhile in Italy, they recorded people in hyperscanning with EEG while they were playing cards. And in that case, they showed that there were like greater similarity at the informational, in the informatic sense, in computer science sense, between the brains of people within the same team playing the card game. So that's already give a glimpse also that by being bounded in the team, sharing something, help to have a similarity at the brain level. But again, here the thing is that it was also a sequential game, not really the coupling at the sensory model level. And so in 2007, there was also like the Scott Kelso's lab on the other side of Atlantic who did sensory model coupling with hyperscanning. But instead of looking at relationship between brains, they looked at markers within brains that were specific to the situation where you have to coordinate with others. And they found that indeed there is like such a marker, like signature, that you have a propensity to coordinate with others when you compare to, at contrary, to be desynchronized with others. So like there is a marker in the brain that correlate with that. And interestingly, it was in the right parietal region. For neuroscientists, it would be a kind of follow-up in the talk. For others, just that you will see many times that there is like a right hemisphere thing that seems to pop up in many results. And interestingly, they were reporting in SFN in a poster that they were observing idiosyncratic patterns of synchronization between brains without having like statistical power to show that it was robust enough. And then came this paper. The sound is not. So I would try with the computer. So it's a German team in Berlin who took a professional guitar player and recorded their brain activity simultaneously while they were playing. So if you know actually this song, I would be really interested. I never managed to know what was the song. And they measured brain synchronization across these dyads of guitarists, synchronized with the metronome. So in that case, it's a kind of entry point because there is a common external drive, the metronome. But they were like coupled through perception and action and also through the sound they were producing. And they were able for the first time to prove that there were like ongoing bursts of synchrony between the brain's activity of the two guys. So in my case, I was working with a developmental psychologist, so the one who filmed the children interacting with the chair on their heads. And she had done like behavioral hyperscanning in a way a long time ago by recording babies and their mother and how a baby at 3 months old is already sensitive to temporal contingency and is able to detect a pre-taped recording of their mom or their mom in real time. So at 3 months old, they are already able to do that. And so we took the same kind of idea and tried to set up an experiment about joint improvisation of hand movements. And people were like seeing each other hands through a video, so we can control for real time or not. And meanwhile, they were recorded at the brain activity level. Oh, everything synchronized, so the video and the EEG. And so that goes like this. At the beginning, they are like just in a control condition, not moving and not seeing each other. So like this is the camera, but they don't see anything. It's like a blank screen. Then they start moving their hands, but still not seeing each other. So the instruction indeed is move your hands continuously in an intransitive manner. Do not do meaningful signs like counting or cutting with scissors and so on. And imitate the other whenever you want, whenever you feel it's good. So they now they are seeing each other. And you can observe that there is like a turn taking place in a leader-follower kind of way. So one person is starting to move and the other initiate a new movement. And there's this self-organization of the imitations that is taking place. And on the bottom line here, you see the software that I had nightmare for 11 months. I grade frame by frame all the interaction. Of is it synchronized, so is the movement starting and ending simultaneously, or is it imitation? Do they do the same movement, but not necessarily synchrony, but delayed as well? And who is driving the interaction? And then I had to find another guy to do that, which was also not easy, to make an inter-observer agreement and so on. But so all the dyads were analyzing this very fine-grained perspective, and then so we had like the behavioral analysis, and I would present the brain-related analysis afterwards. So the behavioral results already it's kind of correlating with the intuition that we are more have a propensity naturally to get in sync and imitating each other. So the most of the time, the task was also priming for that. People were imitating and in synchrony. And the second part is not imitation, but synchrony without imitation. So you can see that in the metro, for instance, like people, even when they are not told to do that, tends to get in sync in their movements. And here it was the same. Even when they were doing different movements, they tend to do it in the same pace. Then there were like imitation without synchrony, so with more delay. Technically, it was more like at the initiation of a new movement and when the movement were more complex. And the last part is no synchrony and no imitation, which was initially thought as an absence of social interaction. But in a way, and we discussed that yesterday, afterwards we realized that actually that was the times where people were indicating that they were bored or that they want to change turn and so on. So even it's hard actually in a social context like that to have a non-social thing. It's like even the absence of synchrony and coordination is already a kind of signal. So now we go to the brain level, and the idea is to take this fine-grained behavioral analysis and take the brain activity from one brain and the other, extract the phase of the signal. So I won't go in the mathematical manner, but the idea is that when you have the electric waves at the brain level, you can already qualitatively see that there is like a more coherent oscillation there than there. But since we have to assess that in an objective manner, we use mathematics. So you can build up metrics for that. And then you can do that for all electrodes. So you can have in real time what's going on within the brain of one guy, of the other, and between them. And for making long story short, by using other statistics and so on, you can end up to show that indeed there is more synchronization between the brains of the two people while they are in sync at the behavioral level. And to make a connection with what Uri presented yesterday, here it's funny because we compared the phases where the people were in same pace versus when they were not in the same pace, not necessarily doing the same movement. And what we find is, again, this right temporoparietal junction, right parietal area, which to me is dealing with the predictor that are synchronized between the two persons. And indeed, there's a lot of results showing that this area that have been really assigned to social thing is also present in very basic temporal attention. So to get in sync with others, you have basically to have attention that is to the time, basically. So in that case, that's the sharing of information that we're measuring. But so we have these brain synchronization results that at start was hard to swallow and to publish as well. And then there is also another result, which is more like, well, we have this spontaneous interaction, which was kind of new. How we can compare with another task, which is more like forced directional. Like if we take the self-organized social interaction and we compare with like subject A imitates subject B, is there a difference? Indeed, there is a difference. So it kind of question the generalization of results that are in more spectatorial or one brain, one person kind of results. When you are engaged in a dynamic interaction, then the brain activity at the objective level is already different. So it kind of question where how we can deal with that. And that was also replicated with fMRI. And you have like an effect of the social role. Are you more leading or following? But also the context, so spontaneous versus induced. So then I will go fast on that. But the idea is that this interbrain synchronization leave more question than answer. I mean, the A to B thing, saying that now it's related to temporal attention, at that time we have no clue of what was the mechanism behind that. But so in the second part, I was like wondering to what extent the fact that there are two people and they share the same anatomical structure, the same biology grounding, is already contributing to the fact that they are synchronized, like even without being exchanging information. And so a basic idea coming from physics is to make a model and see how the structure influences what you're observing. And so I combined the structure model with the dynamic. The structure was called the connectome, so taking fiber bundles and atlas of brain area, I can construct a virtual brain, and by making copy-paste, I had two brains for the price of one, and then synchronize the motor area of one brain to the visual area of the other, and vice versa, and kind of simulating what was going on in the experiment, basically. And so, since time is running, the idea is that you have oscillations for the each individual brain part, and you can play with the connectivity within the brain and between the two brains. And the thing is that you can do something that you cannot do in real, which is like shuffling the connectivity between brain area to see what's the impact of the structure of the mesh, the network of brain area that I spoke at the beginning. And so I would skip that. The two big message is R, that first, the real structure tends to facilitate the coupling compared to a random structure. So already, even without having exchange information, so this the axis here is the amount of information exchanged between the two brain, already at the ground start zero, there is a difference just based on the anatomy. But when you are starting to exchange information, the random part, the random version doesn't really get more synchronized, while the real anatomical one, the one that has been selected evolutionarily, tends to facilitate even more the perception-action coupling. So the thing is that at the intra-individual scale, people already knew that the structure tends to facilitate the way we integrate information within the brain and between different brain area. The wiring is made like that. But at the inter-individual scale, what I brought up on the table is that it also tends to facilitate our perception-action coupling. So the final part is how to combine the two. So you replace one brain with a fake virtual brain, so to say. So you replace one part of the dyad with a model. We call that the human dynamic clamp because it's inspired by a technique in physiology called the dynamic clamp. But here it's at the human level instead of cell level. And so the thing is to create a perception-action coupling with a virtual agent in real time. And with that, you can play with the coupling either in one direction. So the avatar is affecting the human, but the human is not affecting the avatar. The other way around, with the human could not see the avatar, so it's not influenced by it, or by having bidirectional coupling. And you can probe to what extent there is indeed something that emerged by the bidirectionality compared to the unidirectionality. So you can check this plus one paper by Scott Kelso that investigate that. In my case, so I develop an open source version. You can check it out and even fork it and modify it. In my case, I wanted to probe the neural basis of what make us human, or at least appear human to others. And so the task was to have an interaction with this avatar, and people were kind of say, you may interact with a machine or a human. Of course, it was always a machine. But what does it feel when you interact with it? And you had like a verbal report at the end of each interaction. And I was manipulating the fact that the avatar was either cooperative, competitive, was a difficult or easy task. And so the idea is that when the avatar is cooperative, competitive in a mathematical sense, so sharing the same goal as the human or not. So the task was very easy. It was like either being in sync or out of sync, like anti-phase. And so when there were like shared goal, people were perceiving the avatar as a cooperative partner. And when they were not sharing, they were indeed perceiving it as a competitive partner. And so there are two interesting results. So being a bad partner after being a good partner is the worst way of being rated. So don't be bad after being good. Either like stay bad all the time. And the other way that is interesting is that when the task is more challenging, so for instance, coordinating anti-phase is more challenging, the people were blaming the avatar, whereas the avatar was mathematically exactly the same cooperator. So that they were like attributing the fact that it was more difficult to the fact that the other was less cooperative. So the initial idea was humanness may be related to cooperativeness. And in fact, it was not. Like, some people have bad idea of the humans, some have good, and there were no correlation between the rating of humanness and actual cooperation. But what was apparently predicting the sense of humanness was the unpredictability of the avatar and this kind of contingency that we spoke at the beginning with the children mother. And so there's like a famous Eider and Simmel, where like you have shapes moving in a not completely random, but not completely ordered manner. And in our case, it was indeed the switch of behavior that was more predicting the humanness. And so I won't have the time, but we had also integrate the neural part to record the brain activity while the people were interacting. And so as a conclusion, I would say that we have measured different level of similarity with this interbrain recording, first at the neurobiological level, but also at the task and behavioral level. So doing the same thing, of course, tends to make the brain activity similar, but also at the cultural level. So there is like guys like Kitayama working on cultural neuroscience and how actually sharing the same cultural norms make the brains more similar in the brain activity. But so we are also measuring communication, either in unidirectional and reciprocal. And the thing that's interesting is that the similarity tends to facilitate communication, but actually the reciprocal communication that we have all within each other is the byproduct that share our cultural similarity afterwards. So there's like a bidirectionally causal effect in there. So I will skip that. And I would say like, so in the same way that in the brain we are dealing with different types of activity, so either like very discrete spike and people tends to see that as a symbols discrete map in a discrete fashion. There's also emergent oscillations, so more continuous things. I would say social dynamics is in between these representation, symbols, discrete thing, and the self-organization that we have through our coupling. And the big questions are how these two aspects relate to each other to me. What are the general principles and the specific mechanism? So how we can have something that is more general and universal. And the big deal to me, and indeed here it's a good way to exchange, is to relate the first person perspective, the phenomenal experience, the second perspective to be interacting, and the third person, which is more like objective neuroscience. And I will finish on this diagram by Francisco Varela that was entitled Step of Science of Interbeing, that is really talkative about the problem of seeing others in cognitive science. So seeing like in the computationalism, classical computationalism, others are a problem because like you have to represent something that represents, something that represents, and it's unsolvable basically. And we are moving to integrate the interactive fashion, but ultimately, and he was postulating that in 2007, but we are far from there now, to have a phenomenological account at the collective level. So how we can, as we are doing there, share our phenomenological experience as an artist, as scientist, and so on, and build up a theory that integrates all this phenomenological experience. So these are all the guys I had the immense chance to work with and still collaborating. And thank you for your attention.
Thanks, Guillaume. This was wonderful. And also, I'm always amazed by this physicist way of looking at really big question and looking for very concrete solution and models. Wonderful. Let's hear some more people we haven't heard from. So over there.
So fascinating talk. Thank you. So I had a question about the hand imitation task. Mm-hmm. So you mentioned there was an imitator, there was the model and the imitator. So I was wondering, because it sounded like in your instructions, you didn't instruct them to do that. So I was wondering if is this something that you extracted from the data?
Yeah.
And so then the second related question is, if you, because we've been talking about co-confident motion, and I'm wondering if you it sounded like you did mostly behavioral coding, so I'm wondering if you were able to see any of that level of synchronization where there's no imitator and no model, but
so I'm not sure I understood the second part. For the first part, we had like two conditions. So we have like forced imitation, induced, so that A imitate B, and then we have the free spontaneous imitation condition, where like they were free to negotiate who is leading, and there were like this turn taking occurring. So there were like three tasks: A imitate B, B imitate A, and A and B do whatever they want. But they move their hands and they imitate if you want.
Okay.
Yeah.
Because in the models, when you were describing the results, you mentioned them separately. So then, my second question was this follow up of: were you able to find? Were you able to? Maybe it was especially in this third round of togetherness. So motions that weren't, you know, one reacting to the other, but being done together. Maybe
the way. Done together. Okay.
Maybe what you're talking about is just synchronization.
No, I got it. So, I'm rewinding. The idea is that we found indeed. With the subjective interview afterwards with the subject, that they were experiencing what people called the state of flow or this kind of dilution of their own movements into a kind of
togetherness.
Yeah. Uh-huh. And so this could be a marker of that, but what was funny is that in the spontaneous context, compared to the induced one.
So spontaneous is like no leader, no follower.
Yeah, okay. Exactly. We had these patterns that was in the gamma band and also involving like more the parietal region, who was not observed in the induced one, and that was completely symmetrical. Like there were like no leader, no follower, but was very characteristic of the spontaneous imitations. And in a paper we entitled "Does the Brain Know Who Is the Origin of What During Spontaneous Imitation?" We tried to decipher through the different condition attribution of action, so agency, to the other, to the self, and by playing with all the condition, try to decipher all that. And for this one, we ended up to call that co-ownership of action because it was like the best way we had to make sense of it. But indeed, like people were reporting that at some point in spontaneous imitation, they were co-sharing what was going on. They were not experiencing it as, yeah.
What was the question of the best?
Yeah, I don't know if I still
have it. Maybe you want to take the mic?
Yeah.
It can also be just a comment.
Yeah, it. Sorry, it was a really interesting talk, and it just made me think your last part of your talk about the human avatar interaction that you found that what made the avatar behaving more human was basically the unpredictability. While we are also in your talk, we are also looking at joint synchronization as a part of basically the base of the social interaction. So, how can be these two things reconciled with each other?
That's a good question. Yeah. So we were like talking yesterday about the togetherness, but also the acceptation of the others driving you outside of your comfort zone. And in this, like in between of that, like the mirroring is part of it, but total mirroring is not really human. When I started with the this avatar paradigm, the first models were like super good at mimicking, but people were like, this is completely awkward. This is not like, yeah. And I remember one night with a PhD student, we were like very late in the lab and completely sleep deprived. And I don't know how I put it, but I think I inject a lot of noise in the, but pinch the right amount. And he felt like it was a ghost in the machine because it was just this unpredictability and predictability balance that was playing. Unfortunately, it was also caused by sleep deprivation, apparently. But
thanks. Yeah, more questions. Yeah, Saul, maybe.
Hi. Really interesting. I was wondering about, yesterday you asked a question about turn-taking to that panel, and I wondered about your perspective on turn-taking, which you mentioned a few times in the in some of these experiments, and how you were using these, how you were segmenting these actions. And then a connected question is, when you talk about actions, I'd be curious to know what you mean more specifically.
By actions?
Yeah, so what would your kind of, maybe the first question on turn-taking first, and then I'd be curious about, action.
So for turn-taking, it was an outcome of the analysis to see this switch of patterns between leader, follower, and so on. Well, my co-supervisor was expecting that, but I discovered this self-organization. And I didn't have time to dig into it when I was in PhD, but when I moved to Kelso's lab, we had a lot of discussion about metastability and how we have these synchronized dwelling patterns sometimes in nonlinear dynamical system, where you have systems that are definitely deterministic in their equations, but tends to be very coordinated and then escape of this coordination, dwell, and then go back to coordination and so on. And I didn't had the time to publish a paper, but I did a poster in SFN about that. The interesting thing is the distribution of the temporal switch that I observed. That's why I asked this question, if in your experiments you observe different switch. To me, it was correlating with the temporal structure of default mode network oscillations, very slow kind of. And I'm wondering to what extent the oscillation of the default mode in between people are creating this kind of metastability, or you are in sync, attention to others, attention to yourself, attention to others, attention to yourself, and that the turn-taking emerge from differences in this rhythm. So if you have like two fMRI and want to collaborate, I'm really willing to investigate that.
Right now.
Yeah, we have time for two, three more questions, maybe someone we haven't heard of so far. Yeah, so Stephen, please. There is a mic there. I'm keeping the mic to control the process.
Can you go to your next slide with the hyperscanning result? I'm just...
This one?
I mean, I've not seen this kind of data before, but is it required that you have the same area in the two brains? Is that part of the result that you constrain, that it has to be the same area, or could it be left with right?
Yeah, no, it can be either. And actually, so the people tend to see it in a very symmetric fashion. It is the true for the alpha mu rhythm in blue, but actually the red one is asymmetrical. So like the model, the one who initiate, tend to share similarity of dynamics in the more frontal region with the more posterior region in the imitator. So like the part of the, we talked at that time of kind of inter-individual top-down modulation, like the prefrontal cortex of one guy is driving the low-level sensory motor of the other. So there is not necessarily a perfect symmetry in that. And indeed, we are going again with this mirroring, not mirroring thing, where like if you have only mirroring, you miss something. And there's a lot about complementarity and being not equal also in the interaction. Yeah.
Thanks. Yeah, Ila?
I just wonder, just one small question. The participants, they knew each other? They were friends or just anonymous?
So that's a good question. We discussed briefly with Lauren about that yesterday. They were not knowing each other. Mm-hmm. I did pilot experiment with people that know each other, and results of turn-taking basically were very different. So like, there is a kind of social etiquette of having half-time speaking, while people that know each other tends to actually not follow that. So there were like people knowing the other was more like shy or so on, and there were like huge imbalance in turn-taking, with people really leading the whole experiment sometimes. And in the case of people not knowing each other, they would tend to be more polite, and it was half-half.
And I have one more idea, that like doing the same experience, but measuring their level of oxytocin or cortisol.
Yeah.
Because that's what's missing here in the whole brain.
So Jacqueline Nadel, my co-supervisor, studied a lot the fact that actually what have been shown with oxytocin is very similar to what we observe in spontaneous. So the brain correlates of oxytocin type of task are very similar to what is difference between induced and spontaneous in fMRI. Okay. And so that actually there is a reward kind of thing going on in the spontaneous interaction that so she called that like a spontaneous imitation as a oxytocin nebulizer at the behavioral level in a way. Okay. So that would be very interesting to compare within the same experiment those effects, yeah.
Last comment, Christobel, and then we have a coffee break. Can you pass on?
I was thinking about which medium you are trying to look when you are study this synchronization between two minds, because when you have one mind, you know, so one brain, you know, you can go physically to the time of the cells, of the neurons starting to fire. So this, like, you can make an explanation of the synchronization inside the brain in the physical way. So how much time they have, no? But when you have two brains, I think you don't have this medium, but maybe you have the other medium that is behavior or cultural action. So then I was thinking, okay, what happens if there is someone, or do you know something about synchronization between two brains, but without this medium of interaction? I was thinking because, for example, in synchronization in bands, in other bands, like resting, when you don't have this interaction. That's my question.
So on that, that's exactly the part of what I explained there. So that you have residual synchronization in absence of coupling. So that's so these axes indicate, so one is like you are really connected by perception and action with the other, and zero is like you are in two separated rooms, basically. And only there, you have already a level of synchronization because you are not basically two random number generator. So you are not pure noise. So the fact that you are two biological organisms of the same species, you are sharing some dynamics intrinsically. Then, and now I'm working on autism. I didn't have time to discuss that today. But the fact that you are also more similar at the anatomical level play also in this spurious synchronization. And the interesting part is the difference between this without communication and this, like what this stands for, like the difference of coupling that is purely caused by the exchange of information. And in that case, that's why we compared like synchronous period between humans and the period where they were not synchronous in their movement. So in both cases, they were in the same contact, they were the same humans, etc. The only difference in the two cases was the fact that they were coupled at the time level.
Thank you, Guillaume.